You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
For over two centuries, political leaders in the United States of America have been fixated on the idea of bringing the island nation of Cuba into the American sphere of influence. Now, under the leadership of Donald Trump, direct military intervention in Cuba seems more likely than it has since the early 60s. The former Cuban president Raul Castro has recently been indicted by a grand jury in Miami, leading to a speculation that the Trump administration may use the same strategy deployed in the indictment and subsequent abduction of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. To discuss the history of U.S.-Cuba relations and the prospects of military intervention by Trump, I spoke to U.S. history expert Dr. Paul Tayon. Lately, we've heard Secretary of State Marco Rubio describe Cuba as a national security threat. We've also heard Donald Trump claim that he will be the first president in 70 years to take action against Cuba and put an end to that threat once and for all, strongly hinting at a military takeover. Now, this obsession with bringing Cuba into the American sphere of influence has a long history. Over two centuries ago, in 1820, Thomas Jefferson said that the island was, quote, the most interesting addition which could ever be made to our system of states. So as a historian, could you give us a sense of why Cuba has loomed so large for so long in the American geopolitical imagination? And to what extent are these national security concerns actually warranted?
Cuba has figured in the American imagination, you're absolutely correct, for since the early 19th century. And as a historian, I would say the best way to understand that place of Cuba in the American vision is understandable in terms of the way in which American leaders, and indeed many Americans from the very beginning of the American Republic, conceived of their new nation as a rising empire. And I use that term very specifically to mean an empire, as Thomas Jefferson put it, as an empire of liberty, that is a democratic republic expanding across the North American continent. So American leaders assumed and worked to make that happen. Now, by the second decade of the 19th century, such figures as Jefferson himself, as you mentioned, but also the Secretary of State under President James Monroe, John Quincy Adams, also envisioned American influence extending beyond the continental United States to Central America, the Caribbean, the Western Hemisphere. And, of course, the Monroe Doctrine, which John Quincy Adams, as Secretary of State, authored, stood as that declaration of American hemispheric dominance, or at least an aspiration to that role in the Americas. Cuba figured as one, as perhaps the one of the key island nations in the projection of U.S. power across the Caribbean and across Latin America. And I could say more about that history and the bee in the bonnet that many Americans and American leaders have had about Cuba from the 19th century all up into the present. But to skip straight to the present and Rubio's assertions of Cuba as a security threat must be taken within the context of that longer-term American fixation on Cuba as having to fall under American influence, if not control. And so the exact nature of the security threat is curious, given that Rubio has suggested that Cuba serves as a point of projection of power for Russia and China. Given the blockade on Cuba, it's rather hard to see just what is the nature of that security threat, and the fact that Cuba has been struggling in many ways since the end of the Cold War and the loss of its patron in the Soviet Union on the one hand. And on the other, well, it's the overwhelming military capacity of the United States.
I mean, that argument that you mentioned of Cuba as a kind of staging post for Russia, I mean, that made sense back in 1962, but times have changed, right?
Correct. And as you're referring to, Toby, the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962, where the Soviet Union with Cuban government's approval, built missile launching sites in the north shore of Cuba, about 90 miles away from the U.S. mainland. And that stood a clear security threat. And that then led to the missile crisis, where the world stood probably as close as it ever has to all-out nuclear war. Fortunately, President John Kennedy and Premier Nikita Khrushchev negotiated that the removal of Soviet missiles. At the same time, it's worth noting that part of that deal secretly was the removal of U.S. missiles from Turkey within striking distance of the Soviet Union. Though today, the most that Cuba seems to be able to mount, which is not to be discounted, would be drones which could be used to attack the United States, much in the way that Ukraine has used drones very effectively against Russia. And that goes to a side comment I'll say here, and that the U.S. war in Iran and the Russian war in Ukraine have some commonality in that they are asymmetrical, and that these heavy military powers are finding themselves suddenly struggling to cope with asymmetrical warfare using drones. All that said and done, it's hard for me to imagine that Cuba would launch drone attacks against the United States, knowing the weight of a possible U.S. military response and intervention.
Recently, Marco Rubio delivered a video address to the Cuban people in Spanish, promising to build a better future with American help. And for the first Latino Secretary of State, taking action in Cuba has a degree of personal significance. According to Rubio's telling of his family history, his parents left Cuba in the 50s and decided they couldn't return after the country's shift to communism. There's a fairly large demographic of Cuban Americans, especially in the state of Florida, with very similar life stories. So how do Cuban Americans view the communist government today, and how did they fit into the wider political landscape of the United States?
Great question. Starting with Rubio himself, he is the first Cuban American Secretary of State. He is actually the first Cuban American to occupy such a position of influence within the U.S. government. That said, it's also curious. It's interesting to note that in the formulation and implementation of U.S. foreign policy, Rubio has been all but frozen out of everything except with the Americas. That said, this has been Rubio's longstanding life ambition to effect regime change in Cuba. And that is understandable, and I would suggest, in the first instance, in the longer-term U.S. relationship with Cuba, which dates from the Monroe Doctrine, runs through the War of 1898, and U.S. Pattern of intervention in the Caribbean Basin across the 20th century, and more immediately in terms of the hatred of families like Rubio's and Cuban expats. I call them anti-Castro emigres who left Cuba in the aftermath of the Cuban Revolution of 1959, and have maintained a conservative, anti-communist, anti-Cuban political community in the United States, heavily centered in Florida since the 1960s. And indeed, this community has made itself an influence within the Republican Party. Rubio now stands to possibly achieve a life's goal. And in this regard, I can't help but understand this policy as very personal for Rubio.
Last month, a grand jury in Miami indicted Raul Castro, the 94-year-old brother of Fidel. After taking over from his brother, Raul led Cuba as president from 2008 to 2018. He's now being charged with murder based on his connection to an incident in 1996 in which four Cuban-American anti-communist activists flying small planes over the country were shot down by the Cuban Air Force. So what is the logic of charging a 94-year-old former president with murder?
This is very interesting. The event to which you refer was an attempt on the part of, again, these Cuban anti-Castro emigres, activists flying planes over Cuba, as I understand it, to drop propaganda leaflets. They were shot down, and this is disputed, just outside or just inside the Cuban international boundary in terms of airspace, without any warning. And this, though, must be understood in the context of repeated overflights of Cuba before the incident in question. And so this indictment stands alongside the actions of the Trump administration in Venezuela, of course, with Maduro. And it begs logic in terms of sovereignty, the indicting of Raul Castro in a U.S. criminal court. But as to the why of this, there's multiple ways of thinking of it. As President Miguel Díaz-Canel has suggested, it's a political maneuver designed to set the pretext, along with Cuba as a foreign security threat, for intervention in Cuba on the one hand. On the other hand, it could be a sideshow to take attention off the failing U.S. war in Iran. Or, and this is how I like to see it, as compared with U.S. interventions in Central America across the 19th and 20th century, which have been justified in the language of liberal internationalism, that is, we stand to spread democracy and the benefits of the American way through trade and government. In this case, despite Rubio's rhetoric, I see this really much more as Donald Trump as a gang boss muscling the competition off his turf. That is how I understand U.S. policy towards Venezuela, and that's how I make sense of U.S. policy towards Cuba. And indeed, that helps me to understand the Trump regime writ large. It's also worth noting that in this Trump government, Trump is a figurehead, but who is actually running the policy in this case? Rubio has carved out for himself and managed to pursue his own agenda, which happens to dovetail with that of Trump.
That was Dr. Paul Theon, senior history lecturer specializing in U.S. history at the University of Auckland.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.